It's Monday, the 2nd of January, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar. Ahead on today's show, Kevin Kinder from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers discusses his favorite songs from 2011, and the world's longest-running radio program will be featured on today's Arkansongs. But first, the beginning of the year 2012 marks the beginning of another election year for presidential, federal, state, and local races. As voters prepare to educate themselves on the various choices available, political parties and academics are preparing to see how the voters make these choices. For a long time, not much data were available on the voting attitudes and preferences of voters from the South. But an academic poll conducted by four researchers from the University of Arkansas's Diane D. Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society in partnership with the Winthrop Rockefeller Institute is already changing that. The 2011 Blair Rockefeller poll provides unprecedented information about the voting attitudes of not only white, African American, and Latin American Southerners, but it also compares these attitudes with those of non-Southerners. Drs. Angie Maxwell and Todd Shields, two of the four researchers, visited KUAF to discuss the poll findings regarding various topics, including the Southern identity and the Tea Party movement. They also told me how they got started.
There actually is a funny story about that. I guess it was 4 years ago, 3 years ago.
Oh, wait, I think.
So Angie Maxwell and I are teaching a class with former Senator David Pryor, and we were talking to him about some of the things that we wanted to do in the Blair Center. And he suggested that we go down and talk to the folks at the Rockefeller Institute, because a lot of the things that we were talking to him about, he had heard similar things from them as well. And we had a student in the class who also happened to be interning at the Rockefeller Institute. And working with her and with Senator Pryor, we made a trip down there and kind of – I mean, I think that the first trip was more of just a discussion, and then they were intrigued enough that they said, please put together a proposal. When we went down – when Angie and I went down the second time, Margaret Reed, who's the chair of the Political Science Department, and Pearl Ford, who's also in the Blair Center and also part of African American Studies, went down in the four – it was just the four of us, wasn't it?
It was the four of us. Mm-hmm.
And we made a formal presentation, and the Rockefeller board was there, and – Mrs. Rockefeller was there, and so it was a little bit intimidating, but, you know, not looking at nodding heads and smiles, we thought, no, I think they liked it. But then even before we made it back, they had called and said, you're funded. We're really excited about this. And
we almost drove off the road. We were so excited.
Now, there are a lot of political polls that are out there, the Gallup, the Pew, and several others, you know, even news media outlets also conduct their own individual polls. But what is so different about this one?
Well, first, it's an academic survey and not just a quick Gallup, you know, political poll, which means it goes really in-depth. And I guess what's really interesting from our perspective and how we got Rockefeller to fund it is that there's very few national polls that have a large enough sample from the South to actually really talk about the South with any kind of authority or statistical authority. And so we said, what, you know, wouldn't it be amazing if we had a national poll with a big enough sample nationally and of the South that you could actually compare the two and see if there really are any distinctive characteristics in the South. And that was kind of the hook that led to the poll being funded and why it's really different than many other polls out there. I mean, a good national sample is about 1,000, and we've got 3,400. And not only do we have this oversample of the South, but we have a huge oversample of African Americans and Latinos, half of which took the survey in Spanish. It's just very, very, very extensive.
Mm-hmm. For me, there's, you know, the distinctiveness of this poll goes back to graduate school. And I took a class from a guy named Malcolm Jewell who wrote a lot about Southern politics. And he was good friends with Diane Blair, too. And in class, he would lament that there just weren't any surveys that allowed you any leverage to talk about the South with any kind of authority. And, you know, even by the time I had become tenured and chairing the political science department, that didn't change. He was really talking about white South.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So even if you wanted to look at women in the South or African Americans in the South or Latinos in the South, not to mention gender differences between Latinos and African Americans, mm-hmm. and, you know, you just couldn't disaggregate the data that mm-hmm. much.
And the only thing that gets anywhere close is something like the census, but it doesn't ask any questions about racial views towards other groups and mm-hmm. public policy
or
preferences.
Party identification.
Most of the time people decide, I'm going to study the South, or I'm going to study this issue in the South, and they just put that kind of artificial geographic boundary on it and never look outside the region to say, was it any different anywhere else? Mm-hmm. Is this a unique problem, or did you just draw a box around it and say, I'm only going to study it here? And part of the problem is it's really hard to figure out, you know, besides like anecdotal evidence and things that seem different or feel different, you know, if there really is anything that's different. And political science was unique because one of the reasons Southern politics developed as a field, a separate field, is because it was a one-party system. It was completely Democrat for most of the 20th century and had an all-white primary and all of these voting restrictions that made it really tangibly distinct. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, there's very little that is more than just kind of what we think and feel and what history shows. And so to actually be able to look and say what's still distinct, what's not distinct, with some survey data. And survey data can only go so far, but it gets us to think in places we wouldn't. For example, one of the very odd findings in the poll, or surprising findings, was that a larger percentage of African Americans than whites feel Southern. Well, what does that mean? What is that identity label? I mean, we don't have the answer in the poll of what that means. To a degree, we can figure out some characteristics, but it can launch a whole nother research agenda for someone else who wants to figure out what is the African American tie to the South. We've just assumed Southern means white, or some of us haven't, mm-hmm. but a lot of books, a lot of kind of popular understanding just assumes Southern means white, and now we know it very much doesn't. We know for a fact with numbers that that's not true, and we have to address that in some way as cultural critics and historians and political scientists.
Now, before we move on, you will have to define for me, oversample, the South. What do you consider the South in your poll?
In our poll, we've used the states that seceded during the Civil War, the old Confederacy. There's great arguments for looking at adding in places like Oklahoma and other peripheral states. And we may consider those things in the future, but for this time, we wanted to really try to say, because a lot of the stuff that's written, it takes those old Southern states and said they have such a unique legal and political history, then this distinctiveness is maintained over time, and trying to see if that was true. So we went back to kind of the original definition of the South. And then oversample, you want to?
Maybe I can. Let me see if I can do oversample without any jargon. Okay. I'll try. But if I do some jargon, you point at me or something. Okay.
Okay.
Whenever you take a sample of people and you've got people you're talking to, the more of them you talk to, the more accurate you are about what they all believe as a group. Mm-hmm. And so when you only have 10 people, say, representing African-American women, we don't feel very confident that we know what all African-American women think. So when you oversample, you're going back and finding more of those people in that particular group until you reach a point where you think, you know what, we're pretty confident now. We know what that group thinks.
The more people you have, the lower your kind of margin of error. It's weighted to reflect the national kind of percentages of South, inside South, outside South, African-American, Latino, white, all those kinds of things. So the more people we get, the more accurate we are.
Could you discuss more of your findings, your part?
Sure. We found that when you really measure the South and you include African Americans and Latinos, so not just the white South, racial attitudes, racism, racial prejudice is not that distinct from the rest of the country. When you pull out just white Southerners, it's kind of exactly what you would think it would be. But overall, when you add in Latinos and African Americans, you get a true picture of the South. It's very, very similar to the rest of the country. Where it's completely different is on religion. Religiosity, when you compare and you include all of these groups and we have this great oversample and this small margin of error, it's just night and day. The numbers of people who are fundamentalists specifically, which literal interpretation of the Bible, hours per week devoted to their church, all of that kind of stuff is very different in the South than it is the rest of the country. So racism still distinct among white Southerners from non-white non-Southerners, but religion kind of trumps everything is one of the kind of interesting findings. And then I've done some work on the Tea Party too, which is not a uniquely Southern phenomenon, but a lot of interesting things. And we weren't even expecting to – we weren't trying to study the Tea Party, but within this large national sample, we ended up getting – a really good-sized sample of Tea Party members, and we had asked them all of these in-depth questions about their racial views and their views on different policy issues. And so we were able to really kind of give a strong profile of who they are and kind of what's driving their behavior and their frustrations and all that. So all of that, those findings were kind of embedded in this poll unexpectedly.
I was reading one of your articles that was on the Blair Rockefeller poll page on the UARC website, and it says, religion, not racism, maintains Southern distinctiveness, mm-hmm. but then Democrats could make inroads mm-hmm. in the South. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate a little bit?
Sure. The kind of understanding at this point is that the South is red or Republican, but we know that Obama won three Southern states, Virginia and North Carolina and Florida, and almost in Georgia. And though part of that was a large influx of registered African-American voters, it was also white voters. And when we look at who's not voting in the South, we pull those people out and see who they are. They're overwhelmingly Democrats. A lot are Latino, a lot are women, and that group is an untapped – they self-identify as Democrats, so they feel some kind of political connection to that party, but they're not being reached, they're not being communicated with, and they're not voting in really high numbers. So when I say Democrats can make inroads, part of the problem is if a region – and this was the problem vice versa – when Republicans could make inroads in the South in the 30s, 40s, 50s mm-hmm. and tried, is that if you assume that the state is red or you assume that the region is red, Republican and Democrats don't try, they don't ever activate those people. I mean, right after the 2008 election, there was a map in the New York Times and it showed increase in Republican voting. So the redder you were on the map, not who won in your state, but which way you went, increased from 2004. And Arkansas was like a red bullseye in the middle of the state. And part of it is because Obama had no campaign here at all. And so that assumed redness is what keeps Democrats from making inroads when our numbers show there's a lot of people who could be kind of pulled into the party. And the Republicans knew this in the 50s and 60s, and it's exactly how they made a move to flip the South from Democrat to Republican. Mm-hmm. They knew they couldn't win a whole election, but they slowly gathered people into the party. And that's what it takes to have two-party competition again in the South, which we don't have in a lot of places right now. So it's either party can do it. It's just right now Democrats have kind of written off big chunks of the South, which our numbers show is a mistake.
Now, if we move on to the Tea Party movement, what is this fear of falling, which every Tea Party member talks about?
Well, we asked a lot of prospective questions of our survey participants. What do you think is going to happen in the future? Do you think your financial situation will get better, get worse? Are you, you know, do you think the country will get better, get worse, and so on. And though the Tea Party members, self-identified Tea Party members, are not disproportionately affected by the economy. I mean, in some cases, they're doing much better than the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. They are overwhelmingly negative about the future. They feel very afraid of their economic situation in the future. They're very afraid the direction the country's going. So it seems to be some kind of intangible fear that hasn't exactly happened yet, but they think is coming. And that's driving them to, you know, into this organization, into this kind of movement.
Mm-hmm. Contrast that to a lot of the African Americans in the survey. Their own financial situation, even their own employment situation, is worse than much of the members of the Tea Party. But African Americans were more optimistic about their own personal future and the country's future, whereas the Tea Party members personally are not – they're doing much better, but they're very afraid of where the country's going.
Even though they're doing well, a middle class, earn between $40,000 and $100,000, mm-hmm. and
– Have higher levels of education.
And very politically mm-hmm. sophisticated.
Very politically sophisticated and voting in record numbers.
Now, we know that the Tea Party members make up about 10.6% of the voting population. How influential are they?
Well, they're not just 10.6% of the voting population. They're 10.6% of the population, period, not just voting.
And that's defined very liberally, too. There would be some, like Dr. Maxwell was saying, these are self-professed Tea Party members. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we took an encompassing view. So they would be 10% of the population from a very liberal counting.
Right. And then they vote, in these kind of record numbers. I think that the Republicans have to deal with them. I definitely think they're ultra conservative compared to kind of a moderate, typical average Republican. And the party has to decide if they're going to try to move farther to the right and absorb the Tea Party, mm-hmm. or if they're going – but they have to be careful, because if the Tea Party really is in a lot of ways triggered – or at least in some ways triggered by Obama, then we'll see their energy kind of dissipate when he goes out of office, whether that's in 2013 or in 2017. And so if the Republican Party moves too far to the right, then they're going to be left with a wide open middle, and that's going to be something Democrats can take advantage of. However, if they don't absorb enough Tea Party views and the Tea Party splits and runs third-party candidates, not even at the national level, that would be, very difficult for Republicans. But at state elections and, U.S. House and Senate elections, that kind of stuff, if they're that dissatisfied, the Republican Party is walking this very, very, very fine line right now. And they're going to have to – and I think that's why we've seen so much confusion and so much frustration in the primaries, mm-hmm. and nobody really able to gain a footing very well with this, with the party as a whole, because it's really kind of fighting for the future of the party right now. And so it doesn't surprise me that nobody's kind of risen up as the expected, nominee at this point. I mean, it's still early, but there's not even really I guess maybe Newt now as a front runner, but nobody over the long haul. And different people leading in such different states is very odd. And so it'll be kind of interesting to see. So they're very influential in terms of swaying who those Republican choices are going to be, because mm-hmm. they're a constant threat to break away. And if they take 5%, 6% of the party with them, it can be a game changer.
Dr. Zanji Maxwell and Todd Shields are two of the four-member team at Diane D. Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society that partnered with Winthrop Rockefeller Institute to conduct the very first Blair Rockefeller poll. We'll have more details on the poll findings, including ones regarding the Southern identity and the voting preferences of elderly Americans, in a few minutes. This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar. The election year is here, and several federal, state-level, and local races, along with the presidential, will decide the fate of individuals and policies that will shape the lives of millions of Americans over the next few years. I interviewed Drs. Angie Maxwell and Todd Shields from the University of Arkansas's Diane D. Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society late last month to gain more insight into how the Southern identity shapes a voter's preferences and how elderly Americans are increasingly inclined to cast their vote in the favor of the Republican Party. We now continue our conversation. If you move on to the elderly Americans part of the poll, now they're increasingly identifying with the Republican Party, whereas in the past they were a bankable source of votes for the Democratic Party. Do we have any possible explanations for that?
I think that, Dr. Maxwell keeps talking about the Obama trigger. I think that that's certainly playing a role, that he seems very different from them. I mean, it surprised me because, growing up and studying politics and talking politics at home, and then, increasingly you would hear things, oh, conservative voters, when mm-hmm. you get older, you get more conservative, that kind of thing. But they were still very much a Democratic voting bloc. I mean, Social Security and lots of government programs that older people rely upon were things that the third rail of politics that you could always count on them to vote democratically. Mm-hmm. And that definitely wasn't the case in the last presidential election. I have a feeling that that's partly because of the baby boom generation. I have a feeling that it's partly because they're doing well and they are among the group that are probably the most worried about their financial economic. Yeah.
For the older community, it's not for the retired community. It's not their unemployment rate. Mm-hmm. It's their retirement that mm-hmm. is what's really driving some of them. And yeah. So, that could be another part of the reason that they're identifying now with this, with, fiscal conservatism mm-hmm. more.
Well, and I think that even there's not only fiscal conservatism, but social conservatism. I mean, the older generation seeing a new social morality being accepted in the high schools and colleges across the country. And that still feeds into this, I don't know that I fit in this Democratic Party that they've voted with for so long. I don't want to overstate that, though, because I don't want to be interpreted as the Democratic Party's losing its base or something like that. I think that just bases are shifting mm-hmm. because we've seen, as Dr. Maxwell said, there's lots of inroads the Democratic Party potentially has in the South. And I think that that's probably the same true with youth. Mm-hmm. And so it's not necessarily that either party is really losing. It's just more that the coalitions are definitely shifting. Like the Tea Party, they vote at mm-hmm. higher rates than you would think that they would otherwise based on their education and their economic standing. They vote more often. So they've had a powerful voice.
Yeah. And how does the Southern identity define your voting attitude?
Ooh.
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is that we're learning that Southern identity means very different things. Yeah. Even when there was just a while ago, the Blair Center held a conference in conjunction with African American Studies and Latino Studies at the university, and we called it the Status of Black, Brown, Arkansas. And we were talking about the Southern identity, and every time we talked about it in terms of white Southern identity. And one of the things that the survey is showing us now that we have the voices of African Americans and Latinos, we see that they have a Southern identity too. What those mean is something that we really want to dig in our next survey, because in all honesty, just finding out that African Americans have a greater identity to the South than Caucasians was really news to us. Now, what's driving that and what it means to them is something I'm really excited to look at.
I wrote one article this semester trying to kind of map what these characteristics were that Southern whites who felt Southern mm-hmm. and African Americans who felt Southern shared. Mm-hmm. Where are they connected? And it's really odd, but they are. They have a much higher opinion of how hardworking each other are. And so there seems to be this belief in hard work. They have a – they're very religious, as I've said before, and much higher numbers believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible. Hmm. So I think any candidate that's going to win in large numbers in the South is going to have to speak a little bit of that language, which is a language about redemption and about suffering. I mean, there's all kinds of you know, words and phrases that kind of tap into that feeling that's a major part of someone's life. And they also feel discriminated against, both white and black. They feel made fun of. They feel picked on at much higher numbers than non-Southerners. So there is this kind of, I think, candidates that try to tap into that. And we've seen that historically work. You know, don't let people make fun of you, and you are the real America. And those kinds of things really work. When we're talking in huge generalizations, mm-hmm. but those tend to work. And those are not just white characteristics. They're African-Americans who feel Southern, too. The problem is we've got such a large number of people living in the South now that don't see themselves as Southern. And so that's become a problem for trying to analyze Southern politics. And that's what's – another thing that's unique about this poll is we have both – people who are geographically living in the South, and mm-hmm. then we also have a way to separate for people who self-identify and feel Southern. And so we can talk about both types of Southern, that physical, you know, geographical Southern and that emotional identity Southern. And they're two very, very different things. And, of course, for presidential elections, you know, you got to care about the geography. Mm-hmm. You do. But if you don't understand the other aspect – you know, there's a lot that can be missed. And so it's just a wealth of information we're just kind of starting to kind of mine through.
And that's an absolute point. I mean, the questions that you're bringing up are fantastic. But we asked a lot of questions about discrimination and how often do you feel discriminated at work, by police.
By courts.
By the courts. Yeah. Is your race been used in a derogatory way? We asked that about Latinos and Caucasians and African Americans. We also asked everyone what they thought. What does it mean to be American? And does it mean you have to be a Christian? Does it mean you have to speak English? Does it mean you have to be born here? And a series of those types of things that, in all honesty, we just haven't had the time to get into yet.
What is the future of Blair Rockefeller Poll? What else will it include specifically?
Well, one of the things, and we're still just in early discussions about 2012. But one of the things we've discussed is including a longitudinal component in the 2012. So having a large subset of people that participated in 2010, taking the 2012 survey too, so we can start a process of just tracking people. So not only getting a Polaroid of mm-hmm. what's happening at election, but maybe getting a glance at the movie that's changing in people's lives. And here's a person who voted for Obama and now they're not, or someone mm-hmm. who didn't vote for Obama and now they are, or somebody who, you know, supported
didn't vote at all.
Yeah, didn't vote at all and now they're here. And so it's another way of us using the resources of these two great institutions to get a really good dynamic portrait of the South. But again, it's not just the South. It's also a very interesting glimpse at the changing racial dynamics of the entire country.
And we want it to be a resource for anyone wanting to publish in this field.
Just to elaborate further on that, I think that our long-term vision is that we'll have this type of information following every presidential election. And so what we hope to become maybe in 10, 15 years is that we're the go-to place when it comes to what's really happening in this geographical region that is driven presidential elections since World War II, and this dynamic, changing, party-shifting region. We'll be the one place that has real data on that.
Well, you know, in terms of like questions and things we want to add, I mean, we'd like to ask some social media stuff and talk a little bit about how people are getting some of their information. We want to push into this one theory about linked fate and how mm-hmm. much, you know, African Americans, whites, Latinos see their fates as intertwined. If one succeeds, will the other fail? Is it seen as a zero-sum game? And I'd like to add some more theory about religion and how it functions instead of just the, you know, belief in the Bible, hours in church kind of, and denomination. And, you know, the ideas just kind of don't stop. Mm-hmm. I really would like to ask some questions about the perspective of some of these female candidates. I'd like an approval question about Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. I'd like to see if that's changed or shifted, if the candidacies of Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann and them have hurt people's impression of women's ability to handle politics or helped. You know, that's a whole other can of worms that I definitely want to open.
The other, I guess maybe this is not even maybe 2012, but long term, I want to open up this can of worms of we've always classified people according to their race, and mm-hmm. we see those mm-hmm. walls breaking down, that we're seeing lots of more people saying, well, I'm this and that mm-hmm. and this and that. And so those traditional barriers or silos are going away, and that's going to bring a whole new dynamic.
I mean, one thing that Dean Shields' findings, I mean, that's really interesting and we want to explore more too, one of his reports, you know, noted that, you know, like as he mentioned before, that, you know, African Americans and Latinos, though they were suffering in this economic, you know, times much
more so
than anyone else, they were optimistic about the future. Well, that may seem like, you know, a kind of so what. But for years, we look at that consumer, you know, confidence index to predict if somebody's going to get reelected or if we're going to have a change of the guard. And that may not work with different communities. That may only work with the standard default white America. Maybe that doesn't work for everybody else. Maybe just because the economy down doesn't mean you change leadership. And if that's the case, and if that's not a function of African-American or Latino identity or any other identities, then, again, we're basing everything we think about politics on kind of a default white behavior. Mm-hmm. And that's not what this country looks like. Hasn't looked like for years,
and,
but,
yeah. and
but
maybe
we haven't
even,
had the information.
Maybe not even just a white, but a white male
yeah.
behavior.
Hmm.
And so all of that, in all honesty, is just – we've just touched the surface with all of that.
And lastly, what would be some of the most interesting observations that could be made in the next election cycle?
Just as, what would we put on distinct to 2012?
Yeah, you know,
what would be
these
like
are the
2012?
Things to look
right,
out
for 2012.
You know, we'd love
yeah.
to see how this goes.
Oh.
Or.
You know, I'm really interested to see if a lot of the new voters that were activated in, you know, 2008, are they motivated to come back again? I'm really interested to see if this fear of the future among the Tea Party, if that's really continuing or not. I'm really interested to see if as the baby boom generation gets into retirement and then they really become dependent upon government programs, is that economic conservatism really going to continue?
Hmm.
I'm really interested to see whether or not African Americans and Latinos begin to see each other as having a linked fate. In all honesty, we talked earlier about game changers. A game changer is if African Americans and Latinos start to see their own fates as interlinked. If that happens and they see themselves as a voting block, then, you know, you could see a Democratic South again, you know, much quicker than if they're competing with each other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested to see if Caucasians start to see from this global scale, you know, the world is changing for Americans. And not just here in the country, but around the world. And
mm-hmm.
if we start seeing ourselves as more linked fate dependent upon how my future is dependent upon your future, regardless of your race, and then, you know, then my global concerns become more of a priority than my state concerns or even my county concerns. And so those are all things mm-hmm. that are still, I think, I'm real interested to see.
Mm-hmm.
And whichever way those go, we could have really different futures.
This is very exciting.
It's very fun.
Thank you both for coming to our studios.
Oh, my pleasure. Welcome.
Yeah,
thanks.
Thank you.
Doctors Todd Shields and Angie Maxwell are two of the four-member team at Diane D. Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society that partnered with Winthrop Rockefeller Institute to conduct the very first Blair Rockefeller poll. In a few days, we'll also speak with another member of their team, Dr. Pearl Dow, about her findings regarding Southern and non-Southern African-American voter attitudes. More information on the 2011 Blair Rockefeller Poll can be found on blairrockefellerpoll.uark.edu. This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar. Each year, about this time, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums compares his list of favorite music of the year with a similar list compiled by Kevin Kinder. Kevin covers music for Northwest Arkansas newspapers. While they both agree it was a very good year for music, Kevin says it was not necessarily a year full of great albums.
I felt that there were a lot of number five kind of records. What I didn't have was that one or two records that really spoke to me, and the ones that I knew were absolutely my favorite. And so I felt like there were a bunch lumped in the middle, but not necessarily these stellar standout, an album that I'll be listening to in 10 years kind of work.
I agree. And actually, I think there were a lot of number 12 to 15 albums. Albums that I bought and I enjoyed, but they didn't stick with me or they didn't seem to be a full album. And I don't know. Maybe that's a sign of the times, how albums are produced and how we consume music. I thought there were a lot of great songs this year. Not a lot of great albums, but some very good ones. My number 10 favorite album of the year is called Thank You, Happy Birthday. It's by a band called Cage the Elephant that's out of Bowling Green, Kentucky, kind of an indie rock slash punk band.
Got to see them a couple times this year perform live, and they're extraordinarily energetic, and I like the album, although it doesn't find my list.
Okay.
My number 10 is from a band from Georgia called Mastodon. And the name of the album is The Hunter. And this is sort of my one metal album for the year. I listened to this, came out in September, and I've listened to it straight through since. It's a hard hitter, but I think the thing I like about Mastodon, they find melody where a lot of bands sort of sludge through that sound. I think that there's some real hook qualities and there's some real emotion coming through in Mastodon's album.
Number nine for me, Gary Clark Jr., a blues guy, and he had, and it's not even a full album, but it's called the Bright Lights EP.
I got to see a little bit of his set at Bonnaroo this year. He's a fantastic guitar player, just remarkable. I didn't get to see much of him. You know how those music festivals are spotty, but what a player. My number nine album is from a duo from Baltimore called Y Oak. The name of the The name of the album is Civilian, and it's pretty sparse. You know, it is a duo, I think, but in songs like Holy Holy, it's really emotive. It's sort of a folk record, but amped up, I think. It has a lot of really nice qualities, and I think it's one of those that I'll be listening to in a couple years.
Number eight for me, Foo Fighters, Wasting Light.
I can't argue with you.
Yeah. I really like that CD.
It's an excellent album. My number eight album is Cults by a band called Cults.
The Cults, yeah.
Came out in June, again, following a trend. It's a duo. They're from New York. They hit it big. They got on a television show, and you know how those things kind of take off. They put out the album on Bandcamp, and it took off, and they got signed to Columbia Records. So I like the song Abducted, and Oh My God is another fun cut.
My number seven album is a soundtrack, and it's one that I've only had for a month, but it's the soundtrack to the movie The Descendants, starring George Clooney. It's Native Hawaiians doing slack key guitar and things like that. For anyone who thinks Hawaiian music is Tiny Bubbles and Don Ho, this is a great introduction. It's wonderful music. It comes from a wonderful movie, and I just I can't say enough. I think if this were 6 months later, that it might actually even move up. I just really like this CD.
My number seven, and I suspect this one's going to be on your list, is an album called Barton Hollow by the Civil Wars. And it's, again, with the duo. This is a really, I called it in my review, a really distilled kind of album in that it's really sparse. We're talking about a couple guitars and a couple voices, and has some definite country elements. It has some folk elements, but what really gets me are the vocal harmonies that these two share on a lot of these songs. They're not married, although it sounds like they've loved each other for years.
Yeah,
it's really remarkable.
My number six is a duo, but it's not the Civil Wars. It's a CD. The first time I heard it, I was disappointed. And I said, well, of course I'm disappointed because there was so much hype about this CD. And then I've gotten back to it, and I really do like it. And it's Watch the Throne, Kanye West and Jay-Z.
My number six album is Bon Iver by Bon Iver. Mm-hmm. And I don't like it nearly as well as I like his previous album, which I put on my number one album of 2008. This one, he sort of comes out of the isolation that he found in the last one.
Number five for me, another CD that I bought within the last 6 weeks, Yo-Yo Ma and the Goat Rodeo Sessions.
I've heard about this, but I haven't given it a lot of time.
It's a wonderful Sunday morning record, and it's got some of his usual folks. In fact, you know who's on that is Chris Thiel.
Yes.
Chris Thiel is on that on mandolin, who, of course, was with the Punch Brothers on Walton Arts Center.
Right.
It's a really good record.
My number five is The Whole Love by Wilco. And again, this may be clouded by the fact that I saw them live over the summer, and they were truly amazing. They finished their transition from sort of twangy pop country from their earliest days to almost a full-on progressive rock band.
Number four for me, this is a CD that Paul Kelso, who has the Generic Blues show on Friday nights, handed me, and I didn't think I was going to like it nearly as much as I did, but I played it over and over for weeks, and that's Revelator by Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks.
My number four is by M83. The album is called Hurry Up, We're Dreaming. It's a electro dance pop record. It's a lot of fun.
My number three, this is no surprise to anyone who knows me, but I think it was a very good record, Blessed by Lucinda Williams. I saw her this year, and I think this is her strongest in years, and there were some of her best written songs ever. If you like Lucinda Williams, I don't know how you couldn't like the CD Blessed, including that title song, which is fantastic.
Great show she put on this year in town, by the way. We were both at that one. My number three is an album called Days. It's by a New Jersey band, Real Estate. And this is one that I just picked up, but it's a surf rock record. It's really reminiscent of the Beach Boys. It's one of those that I actually discovered when I was looking at other best of lists to try to see, you know, some of those albums. And a couple people were talking about this, and I picked it up maybe a month ago, and really haven't stopped listening to it since. It's really breezy, it's pretty light, and it's not a long record. You know, you can get through it in 45 minutes. This may be one of those few records that actually feels like a cohesive unit.
Number two is not a surprise to you. You've already mentioned it, Civil Wars, Barton Hollow.
My number two record, this is a band that I caught this summer and was similarly blown away with. The band is fairly local. They're from southern Missouri, and they're called Ha Ha Tonka.
I love Ha Ha Tonka, and I have not heard this record yet.
This record is called Death of a Decade, and they have sort of an Ozark vibe to them, if that makes sense. They're a rock band, but they have mandolin, they have harmony, they have all of those kind of elements.
I would love to be a contrarian. I would love to be the guy who finds some indie album and says it's the best of the year that doesn't pick what everybody else is picking. But to me, by far, Pillar to Post, the best CD of the year was Adele, 21. I'm with the pack. I think it's the best CD of the year.
She's going to win a lot of Grammys for that, and they're all well-deserved. I went
which is your way of saying she's not in my top 10.
She's not in my top 10. And if anybody knows me, this is not going to come as a big surprise.
Okay.
And I sort of went in an opposite direction when I was trying to pick out that record of the year, and I had trouble sorting through those top records. But I decided to go with an album that I think next summer, you know, I'd want to have a Camaro with T-tops and I'd want them down because I'd have this at 100 decibels.
Okay, that may not be Adele.
It's not Adele. Mm-hmm. It just released December 6th. It's El Camino by the Black Keys.
Which, as you know, I have been lukewarm on, and then I saw them on Saturday Night Live, and I love that single.
They killed that night.
That single is an amazing song. I am warming up to them, and I'm more than warming up. I really like this album, and it's great for an El Camino.
It is, and I think my prevailing thought is when I couldn't find a lot of these records that I think I'll be listening to in 2 and 3 and 5 years, this is definitely an album that I will be able to put in, look back nostalgically on, and say, man, that was good stuff. And
again, I thought it was a very good year for music. But I would even say some of these that I've put on my top 10 might not be things I go to right away in a few years.
I can agree with the same about mine.
Okay. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kyle.
Kevin Kinder covers music for Northwest Arkansas newspapers. He talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Killams about their lists of favorite music for 2011.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Come and listen to my story, if you will, I'm gonna tell about a gang of fellers from down at Nashville. First I'll start with old Red Foley doing the Chattanooga Shoe. We can't forget Hank Williams with him good old Hussick Blue.
The state of Arkansas is known for a variety of musical styles, particularly in the country and folk music fields. However, many are not aware of Arkansas's connections to the origins of the radio program that really established American country music, the Grand Ole Opry. The long-running program may be the single most influential show in the history of American broadcasting. The story of the Grand Ole Opry begins with George Dewey Hay. Hay was born in Indiana in 1895. Following World War I, Hay became a newspaper reporter with a commercial appeal in Memphis, Tennessee. He worked the city court beat and wrote a column called Howdy Judge for the newspaper based on exchanges he heard in the courtroom. The Howdy Judge newspaper column became so popular, they were later collected in book form. Hay also garnered a nickname for his writings, the Solemn Old Judge. Although he was not solemn, had no judicial training, and was only in his 20s. So when the Commercial Appeal newspaper got into the radio broadcasting business by starting its own station, WMC, in the early 1920s, George D. Hay was tapped to become an announcer in the upstart broadcasting industry. Hay edited and scripted the station's program. To signal the begin of the evening's programs, Hay blew into an imitation steamboat whistle, his trademark. Memphis's WMC would also co-opt Hay's steamboat whistle and use it for decades, even as it branched out into television broadcasting. In little more than a year, George D. Hay's natural skills behind the microphone caused him to be plucked away from WMC Memphis to the bigger WLS radio in Chicago, Illinois, in 1924. Here, Hay was the MC for the program that would eventually be called the National Barn Dance. The National Barn Dance would in time be seen nearly as influential as the Grand Ole Opry. In a matter of months at the Chicago radio station, George D. Hay polled as the most popular announcer in America. About a year later, Hay was again asked to join another radio station in Tennessee. Nashville's WSM recently begun broadcasting. An announcer with Hay's pedigree and popularity would help establish the station. And how WSM's hire of George D. Hay would cement the legacies of both with the creation of the Grand Ole Opry. But the threads of the Grand Ole Opry began when George D. Hay was still in Memphis and working for the Commercial Appeal newspaper. He had been assigned to cover the funeral of a Marine who had been born in the Ozark Mountains and died a hero during World War I. After filing his story, Hay spent the day soaking up the local flavor in Mammoth Spring, Arkansas, a town in the northeast corner of Fulton County, right next to the Arkansas-Missouri state line. Hay got acquainted with a farmer who lived in a railroad car with his wife and numerous children. Hay and the unnamed farmer chatted for a while until the farmer brought out his fiddle and started playing. Here's how Hay, the solemn old judge himself, told the story some 25 years later. He invited me to attend a hoedown the neighbors were going to put on that night until the crack o' dawn in a log cabin about a mile up a muddy road. He and two other old-time musicians furnished the earthy rhythm. No one in the world has ever had more fun than those Ozark Mountaineers did that night, Hay wrote. It stuck with me until the idea became the Grand Ole Opry 7 or 8 years later. It is fundamental as sunshine and rain, snow and wind, and the light of the moon peeping through the trees. It'll be there long after you and I. George D. Hay continued to MC the Opry through the 1940s. The legacy of the Grand Ole Opry is broad. Through the decades, the program helped establish what constitutes country music, in addition to establishing many a star in the field. Indeed, Nashville, Tennessee's very reputation as the center of the country music business began with the Opry. As the 20th century matured, so did the relationship between the Opry and Nashville, and country music became not just a musical genre, but an industry. Businesses partnered in to latch on to the Opry name. An Opryland hotel and theme park were even established. when the Cumberland River flooded the city of Nashville in 2010, of primary international concern was the fate of the Ryman Theater, the historic home of the Grand Ole Opry. And to think, it all began with a humble hoedown in a log cabin on a muddy road in Fulton County, outside Mammoth Spring, Arkansas. Here in its entirety is the Grand Ole Opry song, sung by Jimmy Martin, which mentions Opry Master of Ceremonies George D. Hay, who created the long-running radio program after witnessing a jam session in Fulton County, Arkansas.
For 15 years, ain't you? Oh, that's really heavy. Earl never did do that.
Come and listen to my story, if you will, I'm gonna tell about a gang of fellers from down at Nashville. First I'll start with old Red Foley doing the Chattanooga Shoe. We can't forget Hank Williams with him good old Hussick Blues. It's time for Roy Acuff to go to Memphis on his train with Minnie Pearl and Rod Brassfield and Lazy Jim Day. Turn on all your radios, I know that you will wait. Hear little Jimmy Dickens sing, take an old cold tater and wait. There'll be guitars and fiddles, Earl Scruggs and his band or two. Bill Monroe singing out the old Kentucky blues. Ernest Tubbs number, two wrongs won't make a right at the Grand Ole Opry every Saturday night. Gold tooth and plug hat. Cowboy Cope was singing tragic romance. Signed, sealed, and delivered with Sam and Kurt McGee. And the master ceremony was a Mr. George D. Hay. There was Lonzo and Oscar, a popping bubble gum. George Morgan singing candy kisses, yum yum. Got a hole in my bucket, bringing in that Georgia mill. We'll sing the sunny side of the mountain and dance to the chicken reel. There'll be guitars and fiddles and banjo picking too. Bill Monroe singing out the Kentucky blues. Ernest Tubbs number, two wrongs won't make a right at the Grand Ole Opry every Saturday night. Talk about your singers in all kinds of ways, but none could sing the old songs like Bradley Kincaid with his old hound dog guitar and the famous blue tail fly. String beans with Hank's, no, no fiddling chubby wives. There'll be guitars and fiddle, Earl Scruggs and his banjo too. Bill Monroe singing out the Kentucky blues. Ernest Tubbs number, two wrongs won't make a right at the Grand Ole Opry every Saturday night.
The Grand Ole Opry song, which mentions Opry Master of Ceremonies George D. Hay, who created the Grand Ole Opry after witnessing a late-night hoedown near Mammoth Spring, Arkansas, in Fulton County. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
Arkansas Songs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer is Carrie DeVore. For more information or to subscribe to the podcast, visit arkansongs.org.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Bentonville, Bella Vista, Van Buren, and Fort Smith, your NPR affiliate for the past 26 years. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar. Tomorrow, Kyle Kellums and Antoinette Grajeda will be back with another brand new edition. Thanks for listening and have a great week.